New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's former campaign manager allegedly knew about a scheme to cause traffic jams before it happened. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, the allegation came today in the so-called Bridgegate trial in Newark.
Former Port Authority official David Wildstein said he told former Christie campaign manager Bill Stepien about a plan to cause traffic jams in Fort Lee in 2013. The so-called Bridgegate scandal involved closing lanes to the George Washington Bridge to punish Democratic Mayor Mark Sokolich for not endorsing Christie for re-election. Christie fired Stepien after the scandal broke, but Stepien was never charged with a crime. Stepien's lawyer denied the claims. He now works on the campaign of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Wildstein, the former Port Authority official, also testified about how he and others would use agency resources to court Democratic endorsements for Christie. For example, he said the Port Authority spent money on parks in Essex County to win the endorsement of Democrat and Essex County Executive Joe DiVincenzo. Here's DiVincenzo endorsing Christie in 2013.
When he embraced Obama, when he told the Speaker Boehner, and I know what he said to him because I spoke to the governor, about making sure that New Jersey gets its fair share. That's when I made up my mind that Governor Chris Christie, no question, needed to be reelected.
Wildstein's boss at the Port Authority, Bill Baroni, and former Christie aide Bridget Ann Kelly have pleaded not guilty. The federal charges against them include conspiracy, wire fraud, and civil rights violations. Wildstein has pleaded guilty. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Last year, Philadelphia schools suffered through a substitute teacher crisis. A private firm hired to make it cheaper and easier to line up fill-in teachers ended up making bad fill rates even worse. Philadelphia has a new private firm this year, and the situation is substantially better. Though better is a relative term, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arad explains.
In the 2.5 months before winter break last year, Principal Laura Shabilla requested a substitute teacher 31 times. Only twice did a sub actually show up, meaning her teachers had to scramble.
It's exhausting. You don't have time to prepare for your classes. You don't have time to just kind of re-energize for the rest of your day, and it makes it harder on everyone.
Fast forward to this year. Shabilla, who works at Building 21, an experimental high school in North Philadelphia, has needed 3 days covered by subs and has received a replacement teacher every time. That may seem like a small victory, but it's a huge difference in Philadelphia, where substitute fill rates are substantially lower than the suburbs.
We have been thrilled to get subs every time we've had a teacher call out.
This year, the school district's fill rate is 67%. In the first month of last year, it was 17%. The big change this year is that the district brought in a new recruitment firm, Kelly Services. Kelly replaced Source for Teachers, which was widely blamed for last year's woes. Though the early returns are encouraging, the skeptics aren't convinced.
I don't think it's anything to really celebrate about.
Jerry Jordan heads the city's teachers union. Substitutes used to be part of his bargaining unit. Not anymore, since the district hired a private contractor. Jordan points out that Kelly's early fill rates are only a little bit better than what the district achieved before privatization. District brass says rates will improve as Kelly digs in. Critics say they'll believe it when they see it. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arad, WHYY News.
A novel largely taking place in Philadelphia, written in 1999, is about to be made into a movie. Joining me are Lisa Zeidner, English professor at Rutgers Camden and author of Layover, and also Tony Callum, producer, actor, and director of the forthcoming film. Lisa, Tony, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks.
Hi.
Lisa, I'm going to leave it to you to give us a thumbnail sketch about the arc of this book and the central characters in it.
Okay. Woman kind of losing her mind after the loss of her son, goes on the lam from her life, starts staying in hotels without paying. She's kind of a 4-star bag lady, and tries to find a way back to her marriage and to herself.
Although many bag ladies we view and wonder to what extent they're in control of their faculties, this bag lady is very keen.
Yeah, she is. But, you know, there's a lot in the book about losing it, just and how women lose it. Because you know what? Even if you're feeling right on the edge, you still get up and pack lunches. You still get up and send birthday cards. Women keep better control of the things they have to do.
Lisa, you wrote this book in 1999, and much of what takes place was very much of that time, specifically in terms of the modes of communication. And this book is largely about communication or lack thereof, secrecy.
It's true.
So when this is made into a movie, will it be of that time or brought into the 2016 era?
I think Tony's going to have to update. There will definitely be cell phones in this movie.
And Facebook and other forms of social media.
We didn't want to make it into a period piece, which sadly 1999 would already be a period piece. So yes, there are cell phones in the film.
Much of the action of the book is in the covert nature of the protagonist, Claire Newbold. And yet so much of what we learn about her is within her own head. What are the challenges of bringing that to the screen, Tony?
What that was really, since we have to get into the character and film is a very visual medium, I had to either figure out, because Lisa's language is really exquisite and Claire is such a complicated character, I had to find ways to take that, her complicated thought patterns, and turn them into either dialogue or description, or activate them in some way.
To each of you in your tenure as screenwriters, to what extent here in 2016 is it still a challenge or difficult to have a film with such a strong female protagonist at the center?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. I mean, luckily, and I'm grateful that it's been much more in the news lately about what a challenge it actually is. But as soon as you say to, you know, a financing entity that it's female-driven, you have a problem right from the start.
Tony, didn't you tell me there were only like 5 actresses that they'd approve to be in a movie, to headline a movie?
What happens is, even though Layover is a very sexy piece and it has a deeply complicated role, the problem is, as they say, that actresses are not, quote, worth as much as actors in terms of the financing entities. So you're literally given a list, a very small list of actresses that will make your film financeable.
And Lisa, you are alluding to Tony coming in and giving a lecture at Rutgers on Wednesday. What will be the topic?
I'm just really excited to have her talk to our community there about what it takes to develop, to put a film in development. People don't really know what the process is and how arduous it is. And she's been on all sides of this this process. And I think they'll just be really interested to hear what she has to say about the details of getting a film made.
Lisa, Tony, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Tony Callum is director of the forthcoming film, Layover. It's a book written by Lisa Zeidner, English professor at Rutgers Camden. Still ahead this evening.
And I don't believe that paying somebody nothing for the gas that you're taking out is either prudent, responsible, or possibly even legal.
Drilling drama in Bradford County, Pennsylvania, when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Those who've leased their land for natural gas drilling plan to hold a rally at the Pennsylvania State Capitol tomorrow to push for greater protections for royalty owners. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports they're accusing some companies of stealing gas from them by withholding large sums of royalty money.
When the Marcellus Shale gas boom came to Bradford County, people welcomed it with open arms. This region of north-central Pennsylvania now has more than 1,000 active wells. But over the years, the enthusiasm morphed into anger.
You know, it's such a mismanaged mess.
Republican County Commissioner Doug McClinko addressed a crowd of about 700 people who gathered at the Towanda High School earlier this month to talk about royalties.
Please stay standing for a moment of silent prayer. And for those that you are praying, we need help in this. It's a David versus Goliath scenario, so let's have a moment of silent prayer.
Despite the palpable anger, he's a staunch supporter of shale gas and asked for a round of applause for the industry.
And I'd like to have a show of sign of support for this blessing that's under our feet so we don't send any mixed signals from this auditorium tonight.
Gene Lehman was in the crowd. He's leased his land to Oklahoma-based driller Chesapeake Energy, and he did get royalty checks for a while, but recently received a notice saying he owed the company $11,000.
They actually sent us a thing stating that they overpaid us and that we needed to pay them that much. They wanted it by December, and we said, well, you aren't going to get it. So now they're just holding our checks.
Other people are getting royalty checks with little to no money or, like Lehman, receiving statements saying they have a negative balance. Advocates say this directly violates a 1979 state law, which requires oil and gas companies to pay at least a 12.5% royalty. Lehman wants the state to pass legislation to ensure landowners are paid the legal minimum royalty.
It's about time they do something about Chesapeake robbing us from our royalties.
Republican Representative Garth Everett of Lycoming County is the prime sponsor.
And I don't believe that paying somebody nothing for the gas that you're taking out is either prudent, responsible, or possibly even legal.
So now royalty advocates are urging landowners to make their voices heard in Harrisburg.
Hi there. This is information that contains the legislators' phone numbers and emails. We want you to call them multiple times a day, 3-4 times a day.
When he got up on stage, Everett blamed the industry for spreading misinformation about his bill.
They're taking money out of your pocket, and then they're paying an army of lawyers and lobbyists in Harrisburg.
David Fine is one of those lawyers. He works at K&L Gates in Harrisburg and says the royalty issue really comes down to this. How is the gas actually valued? For example, picture a gas well on a rural patch of farmland. There's no real marketplace there. There's no one clamoring to buy it when it leaves the ground.
What you have to do is transport it, and that includes all kinds of things like compressing it, dehydrating it, all kinds of other things to get it to the marketplace.
And that costs a lot of money. Fine says because companies do all this extra work and add value to the gas, they can then deduct those expenses when it comes time to calculate the landowner's share of the royalty. And the state Supreme Court has agreed with him. In a case called Kilmer versus Alexco Land Services, the court said that since the word royalty was not defined in that 1979 law, the industry could use its own definition, which allows drillers to deduct these expenses. Fine says Everett's measure, House Bill 1391, amounts to rewriting thousands of existing lease contracts, which violates the state constitution.
It's not as though the Kilmer definition of royalty is set in stone and will always be that way. The issue, though, is that House Bill 1391 purports not just to change a definition, which sounds very minor, but to change a whole calculation method retroactively to all of these existing leases. And that you cannot do.
While many people believe they are paid fairly, a handful of gas companies have been accused of abusing the practice of withholding these transportation expenses. Chesapeake Energy is facing lawsuits over its royalty practices in about half a dozen states, including one by the state attorney general's office, which the company has called baseless. Most of its Pennsylvania operations are in Bradford County, and Commissioner Doug McClinko says that's why it's become such a hot-button issue here.
The industry should get after these people, make them clean up their act.
The county recently launched a public relations campaign targeting the state's main gas trade group, the Marcellus Shale Coalition, which it blames for blocking legislative attempts to resolve the issue. McClinko's even going after the coalition's president, David Spiegelmeyer, a former Chesapeake executive, who he's called a reverse Robin Hood, stealing from the poor to give to the rich.
I know the guy. I'd go have coffee with him. But I'm telling you what, you know, he's got a job to do, which is mislead the legislators.
For his part, Spiegelmeyer says the low price of gas is hurting everybody in the industry, including royalty owners. And he takes the insults in stride.
I don't take that personally. There's pressure there, and I get that. So that's not about me.
But royalty advocates say they're worried if the legislature doesn't step in, these problems, which are now confined to a few companies, could spread throughout the industry. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Time is running short for the good work done by the Rosetta spacecraft. Let's learn the latest with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, the Rosetta has been cozy with a comet for a long time now.
It's been a really wonderful story, Dave. You know, this started out really 10 years ago when the spacecraft was launched from Earth to head out to rendezvous with a comet. And the intention was that the spacecraft would arrive at the comet, go into an orbit, and then drop a lander on the surface. Everything went according to plan until we got to the landing part about 2.5 years ago. The spacecraft did not land with as much force as was originally expected. So what happened was it bounced, and the first bounce off the surface took it up about 0.5 miles above the surface of the comet. And then it slowly came back down again, bounced again, and then finally landed the third time, but in a really odd and strange location. Just recently, within the last 2 weeks, that location was actually discovered, and it was found tilted on its side and wedged in sort of a cavern-like space under an overhanging cliff. This really limited the kind of radio communication it could have with the orbiting parent spacecraft Rosetta, and it also precluded any possibility that its backup batteries could be charged using its solar panels.
In its simplest sense, a comet is described as a dirty snowball. What more have we learned about this particular one?
So here now we can see this frozen snowball, but it looks like a rock-strewn tiny planetary surface, and in this case, a very odd-looking planet because the planet is made of two lobes. In fact, some would liken this to look very much like the rubber ducky you find in some people's bathtubs. You know, the large bulbous portion that's a body, and then sitting on top of that, a smaller bulbous piece that would be the head. That alone makes it an unusual find because the question then becomes, was it formed this way? Did these two pieces join together? How is it that they're held together? What's the integrity of the comet nucleus itself? And what kind of chemical composition do we find here? And the landing spacecraft Philae, as it was known, actually did identify a number of organic molecules right on the surface and even just above the surface.
If comets could be scooped up collectively with a sieve as an aggregate, would they weigh as much as planet Earth?
Well, there are probably millions of these objects out in what's called the Oort cloud. And the Oort cloud is this shell of material that completely encloses, encompasses our whole solar system right at the sun's almost limit of gravitational pull. And it is surmise that these comets that we see are disturbed from their sort of floating positions in this shell that surrounds us, and the gravitational pull of the sun then pulls them in toward the center of our solar system, where the sun then excites the outer surfaces, creates the coma that we see around the nucleus, and then that turns into the tail that we see, all those sorts of things. But if we could collect them all, it's possible it could come to something like that. But the most intriguing thing about them is the question of whether the frozen gases include enough hydrogen and oxygen that comets could be seen as a delivery mechanism for water being brought to inner planets of the solar system like Earth.
Now we're getting into the sci-fi aspects of what this could portend.
Well, you know, it really gets into the sci-fi when you start to think about the possibilities of going out to maybe grab a comet to do something with a nucleus, to push it around, to use it as a water source in space somehow. But we can look at them as refrigerators or deep freezes, if you will, of the conditions of the early solar system. So that makes them valuable to study as well.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place.
As of today, the Free Library of Philadelphia is loaning out musical instruments. The library has two guitars, a bass, a banjo, a mandolin, and a ukulele, with plans to expand that collection. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins sat in on a library jam session.
To launch its new music instrument collection, or MIC, the Free Library put out all six instruments it currently has and invited anyone to come in off the street and play. It attracted amateur guitar player Scott Lee, Lee says he likes all kinds of music except country music. He just couldn't get into country until he heard a bluegrass band playing recently in Rittenhouse Square.
And wow. You know, you talk about melodies and rhythms that are just popping off the instruments. And the banjo player was really phenomenal.
Lee wants to try out the banjo, but he doesn't know anyone who has a banjo. So he came to the library to check out a banjo for 3 weeks, just like a book.
And I try not to play the same thing over and over again. My fingers just tend to move the same way all the time. So I try to break out of that.
Good job, good job.
There are very few libraries in this country that offer musical instruments, mostly because they need to be repaired constantly. The Free Library has allotted a small budget for repairs, and as soon as it announced it would start loaning out instruments, calls started coming in offering donations of used ones. The idea is the brainchild of music librarian Perry Genovese.
I guess I have a secret objective of rebuilding like the Gamble and Huff Empire, making an army of Philadelphia musicians armed with instruments to just, like, you know, make Philadelphia a city of music.
The music instrument collection will not just benefit library patrons. Genovese says as soon as his lending concept was accepted by his bosses, other library departments chimed in, like the children's department and the culinary department. They want to borrow the instruments for their own special programming. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.